It's Wednesday, October 28th, 2015, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, South by Southwest cancels two panels for next spring's conference after threats of violence. For the second week in a row, we find New York Times editor Dean Baquet defending the work of a reporter and columnist there, this time against claims from Joe Biden. And Yahoo streamed its first NFL game this weekend. We'll talk about how that went. And there's a lot more that we're hopefully going to get to as well. But we're going to start with an ethical debate that played out late last week in Baltimore. A woman there tried to commit suicide in her home. She was not successful and only sustained superficial wounds, all of which could be treated without any surgery. She did not even need stitches. The woman is Gloria Darden, and she is the mother of Freddie Gray. Here's how the incident was reported on CBS affiliate WJZ.
Well, Vic, WJZ has confirmed with multiple sources that Gloria Darden, the mother of Freddie Gray, tried to take her life late last night. The call came in around 9:30 Wednesday night for a person needing medical attention in North Baltimore. Sources tell WJZ that's where Gloria Darden, the mother of Freddie Gray, attempted suicide and sustained superficial wounds. Neighbors watched as first responders arrived on scene.
I seen the police and ambulance all right there. Then, they was taking the lady out and putting her on a stretcher bed.
Sources say Gray's mother was taken from this North Baltimore neighborhood to a nearby hospital where no surgery or stitches were needed. Billy Murphy, the lawyer for the Gray family, released a statement Thursday night saying in part, she is still mourning the loss of her son. The family asks that you continue to pray for her and for them.
So, Ernest, the attorney's family says that this isn't news, that she is not a public figure. She's a mother who's grieving and wants to be left to mourn in public, that this incident never should have gotten the attention that it did.
Well, I mean, here's where it becomes a problem. When you say that she's not a public figure, but she has been out there because of what happened to her son and the aftermath of that in Baltimore, then all of a sudden news organizations have to determine, well, okay, should we or should we not cover this? Is this a private matter or is it not? And at least from my reading of it, there were some news organizations that said, well, wait a minute, we're not going to go down this road. And then you had others that said, wait a minute, she has been thrust out in the public. This is something that the public needs to know. Personally, I would say at this point, with what was going on, I probably would have erred on the side of not going with that. But then we would also have to have this discussion around that. So it wouldn't just be me in the newsroom saying, no, we're not going to do it. I mean, it's got to be a open discussion.
I agree with Ernest. I probably would, if it was my decision, wouldn't have run it. And I hate to say this, I do think she's a public figure, not through anything she did, but not only did her son die, it was a big story, she's received a huge settlement from the city, the police officers are going to go to trial, and I'm sure she's going to be involved in that somehow. So she is a public figure. But what really I think kind of bothers me is, and I almost hate to say it, the fact that she didn't succeed in killing herself probably makes a difference in my calculation, at least. If she had died, you know, I mean, all the reason we just talked about, that would have been a pretty big story and it would have had more impact. But the fact that she came out of it in a, you know, hardly injured physically at all kind of mitigates against running it in my mind.
And the problem I have with the way that that WJZ did the story was that they didn't talk about it within more of a contextual
context.
Way.
I yeah. New context is
because
coming.
I mean, it's, you know, she lost her son. She's had issues in her own personal life. I mean, there's a larger story here that goes untold.
And there's a blog problem. Post actually from, an organization in Atlanta that's on our links blog that went into some of that. And the idea that, this woman needed help, this woman wanted help, and she had seen so many different ways she had felt she had failed her son in life, and that wasn't the part that was being talked about.
Way before her son got caught up in this and died in this tragic way, she was dealing with depression and dealing with all of these issues, and none of that was told in the story. It was all centered around her trying to commit suicide, and it was not successful.
Yeah, I mean, I can respect the folks who put the attempted suicide into context. I can respect publications like the Baltimore Sun that just decided not to run that story. Right. I can respect WJZ to a certain extent. I mean, they had sources that told them, they confirmed the story. I have a little harder time respecting some of the news organizations that essentially just retweeted or attributed
like
the story
Post.
Entirely
Frankly,
to
I'll call
WJZ.
Out, I will yeah. call out the Washington Post yeah. as one that did that, especially with some of the Washington Post sourcing being anonymous yeah. and the Washington Post simply putting the word report to attribute it to WJZ yeah. at the beginning of its headline. Well, you know, we rerun segments of our program online on KBIA.org. We have those via podcast and on YouTube. One of our most popular segments for on-demand consumption in the past year was one that we had on Gamergate. That's a controversy that had spawned a little bit more than a year ago as concerns about sexism grew in the video game culture. It's most notable for the way several female video game programmers and developers have been harassed and physically threatened online. Well, it's grabbed the tech world's attention again, and that happened yesterday when organizers of the South by Southwest Interactive Conference announced that it's going to be canceling two panels because of threats of on-site violence at that conference in Austin. When this happened yesterday, there was some shock, first because of what had happened and the idea of the threat, but then because South by Southwest appeared to be giving in.
Yeah, and in fact, what they had done is they had a process this year that let sort of attendees have a say in whether panels made it or not.
And they have a panel picker yeah, vote for the yeah. panels you're most interested in.
And they actually had a couple. One panel was sort of sympathetic to those who were complaining about harassment of women in the video game culture. And another panel that was basically set up by the Gamergate people, the folks who claim that this isn't about sexual harassment, that it's really about integrity of journalism and covering games. That's kind of a, you know, whitewash in my opinion. But they had two different competing panels set up, and then they got threats. And so they decided, and they said, basically, this is about trying to maintain a civil environment and to try to make sure that nothing bad happens. And so they canceled both of those from each side of the spectrum. And then they couldn't win. I mean, they were attacked by media who said they're withdrawing their participation in the conference. A lot of people raised the question of, well, you're going to here's a subject, harassment, and you're going to cave and not talk about it because you're being harassed. I mean, it's a hard issue.
Well, I mean, this is something that we've talked about several times here on the show about the online culture of being able to harass and sort of try to incite violence and have anonymity in doing it. And I think that's where a lot of this problem is coming from, is that these people have basically shut down a pretty important subject at a place where it could have really gotten some stature in a way that would have been beneficial not only to the gaming industry, but to the whole issue of harassment online, you know, as a whole. And that's where I have the problem with, is that, look, we need, if this is going to be dealt with, it needs to be dealt with head on in places where it's going to get the exposure that's necessary to really deal with
it. Well, and there have been groups such as BuzzFeed, The Verge, a couple of other different publications that have said they're going to pull its support from South by Southwest because of that. It was almost viewed as an act of cowardice in doing that and saying, if you aren't going to face harassment in its face, we're gone.
You know, I we're not inside the heads of the organizers, first of all. There were some reports that, in fact, from some of the women who were organizing one of the two panels, that they were being threatened and harassed before the panels were announced, and that South by Southwest organizers weren't really doing anything about it at that point in time. But if you look on the face of it, what they said they're doing, you've got to feel a little bit conflicted about this. I mean, it was just a year ago that some guy who was fleeing police is charged with driving deliberately into a crowd at the South by Southwest Music Festival, mm-hmm. which is a part of this whole thing, killed four people, injured a bunch of folks. It's a huge conference now, and in some ways, it's the victim of its own success. What, 200,000 people yeah. or something show up, and it attracts crazies. And so you have to worry about what the line is between doing your duty to expose people to these real issues and not wanting to be part of another calamity.
You know, in reading about this, I'm very interested to see what is law enforcement's role going to be in this, because yeah. if they're actually threatening on-site violence at this major conference, then, you know, I'm wondering if the FBI or some other government
or even at the lowest level, the Austin Police
or the Texas Rangers or someone yeah. like that is actually investigating these threats to see whether or not there's some credibility to them and if whether or not some action could be taken. Because I think if you're talking about making a terroristic threat, last time I checked, that was
against
illegal.
The law.
You know, so I'm wondering if we're going to begin to see those stories about law enforcement taking a much more aggressive approach in dealing with those who do these things anonymously online.
Mike, you mentioned in a quiet moment last week that you would have loved to see Joe Biden throw his hat into the presidential race, that it would have been a fun primary season to see what happened with a Clinton-Biden-Sanders field. Well, there was so much hype with the will he, won't he, that when he didn't, it came as a bit of a shock. I mean, we'd all heard the stories about how he was going to run for his son, Beau, who died this summer. But maybe we weren't getting the full story. Take a listen to this from 60 Minutes Sunday night.
There was a lot you had to weigh in this run for president. I know you talked to your son, Beau, about running for president. What did he want you to do?
The first thing I'd like to do, and you're being very polite the way you're asking me the question, because some people have written that, you know, Beau on his deathbed said, Dad, you've got to run. And there was this sort of Hollywood moment that, you know, nothing like that ever, ever happened. Beau, from the time he was in his 30s, or actually his late 20s, was he and Hunter, my two most reliable advisors. And Beau all along thought that I should run and I could win. But there was not what is sort of made out as kind of this Hollywood-esque thing that at the last minute, Beau grabbed my hand and said, Dad, you've got to run, like win one for the Gipper. There wasn't anything like that.
So he didn't name names, but there's a good sense out there of who he's calling out and why.
Yeah, I think part of it, too, is naming the source. I mean, I think if the source would have been named from the beginning, or if you're going to say multiple sources, then name some of those multiple sources, then now you've got a way to sort of go back and say, okay, this person said this, this person said that. And what we're seeing over and over and over again with a lot of these stories in particular done by columnists, is that what gets them into trouble is that they don't name the source. And then it just spreads like wildfire, and other people are picking it up. And because they don't have the source, they attribute it.
The next person doesn't have the source.
Yes, the next person doesn't have the source. And then the story changes because some person exaggerates here, exaggerates there. And you can't get back to, okay, who said what when and what actually took place at that particular moment.
I don't disagree with that at all, and we've said the same thing about anonymous sources for a long time. But I will say this much. I mean, Maureen Dowd quoted Beau Biden in very specific and detailed ways in that story. And if somebody close to Biden or Biden himself didn't give her those quotes, then she made them up. And I would be surprised if she made them up. I'd also say that, you know, you should look at what the vice president said about some other things in the past few weeks after he decided he wasn't running or when he was thinking about running. I mean, remember what he supposedly said in the war room when they were talking about going in to get bin Laden? Well, he encouraged the president supposedly, you know, to take a little more time, get a little bit more intelligence before you go. And then he said, what, in the past couple of weeks? Well, but after that, in a private moment on a staircase in the White House, I said, go ahead, Mr. President. This is the right idea, basically. So politicians re-remember things as events change or their place in things change. So I'm not sure I would lay it all on anonymous sources.
I totally agree with you on that. I mean, I don't trust politicians to actually retell the story in a way that's going to be authentic. But that even more so means that journalists have to name their sources and you have to be able to pin that down and go back. Yeah.
By the way, I think there's one aspect of that 60 Minutes interview that I'm kind of sorry more media didn't pay attention to it. It's almost like we can't walk and chew gum at the same time. Nora O'Donnell did a really good interview, and partway through it, she says something like, part of your speech sounded like, well, I'm ready. I have a plan if you still need me at some point. And then the vice president says, there's some truth to that. But when she started pushing him, he backpedaled when she was insinuating, well, maybe you're just hanging around, leaving the door
watching
open a little
things.
Bit in case something blows up with Hillary Clinton's campaign. Oh, no, no, that's not what I meant. But I kind of think that's what he meant.
Okay, well, one other thing or a pattern here. This is the second week in a row we're talking about Dean Baquet having to come out and defend the reporting at the New York Times, you think we're going to be in that position again next week? Or do we think this is a couple of unhappy people who were reported on and just didn't like what they heard?
Well, I think it's going to be one of those situations. I mean, it's shaping up that news organizations, be it the New York Times, Washington Post, Fox News, you name it. I think throughout this presidential campaign, you're going to have news organizations that are going to be defending their reporting against other news organizations. It's become a part of the competitive nature of news and how it's presented, and in some ways, how they're sort of fighting each other for the segmented audience that's out there watching this.
And frankly, I think it's a healthy thing that news organizations and news managers have to respond to the public. I mean, the New York Times has had to respond on everything from, you know, nail salons to Amazon.com to politics. And as long as, you know, we're willing to respond to the public and give a thorough explanation, that's a good thing.
I think it's part of the whole transparency culture now. Yeah. I think if you're going to be transparent, you're going to have to deal with these things. So.
Okay, so let's talk sports now. Last night, game one of the World Series. The Royals beat the Mets 5-4, but not before a whole lot of craziness on the field and off. There was the first ever inside the park home run that was in a World Series game. There was Fox's broadcast going down in the fourth inning after the primary and secondary generators that were powering the production trucks, they went down. And then word that the Royals starting pitcher, his father died before the start of the game. It was a crazy night at the K.
It was a crazy night. I mean, and it's still going on because you actually have news organizations or sports organizations out there right now basically saying, hey, you know, we don't know whether or not we should have said something on the air about his father dying before or not. I mean, and they're still talking about it. They're talking about the ethics of do you do that or don't you? And Fox chose not to do it, of course, because they were airing the game. But then you had others that were running the story.
Well, and it was even a little more subtle than that because Fox Sports was tweeting about it and Fox News was tweeting about it. But in their game broadcast, they weren't because they were trying to respect the family's wishes and not affect the outcome of the game. And so I think they kind of split the middle pretty well.
And
on
I think
that.
Part of it was that they were told that Vóquez, who's the starting pitcher, goes into the clubhouse in between innings when he's not pitching and he has the television on and they didn't want to say anything that may tip him off that his father had passed.
I thought another interesting sort of just technical issue with this broadcast, you know, you talked about the few minutes that Fox went down because the power went out to their trailer.
So you were watching. So you saw how this all went down. What happened?
I was watching it. And I mean, basically the power went out and they attributed it to power at their trailer, which is their uplink basically to the satellite to carry that game, was down. So for a little bit, they just went to studio and they had some lesser anchor types pontificating for a while. And then it turns out that they were able to pull in a feed from Major League Baseball that they use for international audiences and were able to talk over that for a little while. And when they came back, there was something that I guess I had forgotten about if I'd ever realized it, but the game stopped, not just because there was no TV of the game, but because the managers use instant replay in the dugouts that comes from that network feed, and they were unwilling to play the game without that technology assist.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're going to do that because, I mean, you're talking about a World Series game, and now that they have that instant replay, they're going to want to have that.
Okay, well, Yahoo Sunday offered the first ever live stream of an NFL game. It was something that had been never done before. And CEO Melissa Myers has some interesting reasoning on the strategy going into the game.
The NFL opportunity is just historic.
Well, but you had to agree to pay them. So you're making a decision as well.
Sure, but I mean, I think that when we look at our legacy in sports and the opportunity that we have for our users, the fact that we have, you know, a really extensive network, we've got a lot of server capacity, there's a lot that we can bring to the table. And I think it's interesting, I made this comment last week at our all-company meeting. It was sort of funny, because when I first got to Yahoo, the employees and reporters and others took great fun in hazing me of asking, is Yahoo a media company or is Yahoo a tech company? And all Yahoos get this question all the time, by the way, is it media tech? Is it media-driven tech? Is it tech-driven media? Is it media? Is it tech? And for a long time, I would say that that was one of the company's Achilles heels. And I think that with the NFL opportunity, what you can really see is what was at one point our Achilles heel, that ability to define ourselves, now becomes a real opportunity and a strength. Because when someone like the NFL decides to go digital, we might not be the biggest technology company, but we're the biggest technology company that gets media. We might not be the biggest media company, but we're the biggest media company that gets tech. And so we become a really natural partner to figuring out how to help some of these media companies come online and really find great distribution and a great experience and you know, ultimately build great business.
So a great experience. The results of this experience were, or this experiment were relatively mixed.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, it was a game that was broadcast early in the morning because it was taking place in London. And so it wasn't competing against the big networks broadcast. There's that. Advertisers did buy into the game, but there's some sense that one of the reasons they did it is that Yahoo auto-streamed this game on their page no matter what.
Exactly. So anybody who went to the Yahoo.com homepage ended up seeing the game and then had to actually choose to go away from it.
On the other hand, I mean, online video and live streaming events video is growing bigger and bigger every year. Cisco put out a study this year that I thought was fascinating. They said in 4 years, 80% of consumer traffic on the internet worldwide is going to be video. So it's growing. It's an opportunity to make money. That doesn't mean that, you know, we've got all the kinks out of it yet, as that broadcast showed.
And therein lies the problem, especially when you're talking about live broadcasts of sporting events. People have become accustomed to seeing that wonderful picture, that vivid color, and when they
on
don't
the 50-inch TV or even bigger at home, they want that HD experience.
Exactly. When they don't get that, when they don't see that, when it's pixelated and it doesn't come out quite well, or it stalls and goes to black and that sort of thing, people go like, "Okay, done with this. I'm going to the television." And that's one of the problems that they're going to have to.
But as we see so many more cord cutters coming to the forefront, and people watching their television program through streaming services, and increases in subscriptions to Netflix and to Hulu, and people looking for alternatives to that regular cable subscription. Could this be the future for sports broadcasting?
Oh, I think it is. And in fact, this may have been the first NFL game to be live streamed, but I've watched a couple of Missouri Tiger games on the Watch ESPN app when I've been away from a television
set. But again, that Watch ESPN app you have access to, and correct me if I'm wrong, because it is possible, but you have access to it perhaps because of an ESPN subscription?
Because I'm a subscriber to either cable or satellite. That's right. Now, will there be online-only sports subscriptions, sports broadcasts? Probably, because the folks that provide this content, like the NFL, for example, they know there are cord cutters or cord shavers or cord nevers, people who never have subscribed, and they want to reach that audience if they're going to be a successful business.
And it's one of the ways of cutting out the middleman. They don't have to worry about having to deal with the rights given to CBS or NBC or someone like that.
Well, the reason that I ask about that is because there are many who are saying that the reason behind those 300 or so jobs that were cut at ESPN last week were due to the huge amounts those professional sports league contracts cost ESPN and the Walt Disney Company. So here are some astounding numbers that I'm going to read directly from my script. The network, ESPN, just doubled its annual payment to Major League Baseball to average $700 million a year. And that, with that, is only getting one playoff game per year. An NBA deal that's going into effect next year will triple its cost, and ESPN is now going to be paying $1.4 billion with a B for the year. And it's paying $1.8 billion a year to the NFL. And this is with getting subscriber fees from nearly 92 million households here in the United States.
Those are some huge numbers. And when they start thinking about that, that was one of the reasons why they're basically laying people off is because they can't afford to pay out for those contracts and then pay the salaries of some of the huge salaries of some of the people that they have as sportscasters there.
I mean, and it's kind of a chicken and egg problem for ESPN or others, because live events are still the most appealing to advertisers, because you're not as likely to skip the ads as if you're watching a scripted show or you're recording something and playing it back later off your DVR. So you want to pay the cost of having these really high profile live events, because that's what advertisers will pay for. But the way they managed to cover some of those expenses was charging the highest carriage fees for cable and satellite
companies.
More than $6 per
subscription per month.
But now those people, as you were talking about in the previous story, they're a smaller audience. People are not willing to pay those. Cable companies are looking for these thinner packages to attract the millennials. And so all of a sudden, that floor has fallen out from ESPN.
And it's going to be hard for them to continue to pay those rights fees for those because, I mean, you've also got college football that's going to be on top of that and all the other ancillary networks that ESPN has, like the SEC Network and others. So they're having to deal with that as well. And what you're going to see is that they're not going to have those big names anymore in terms of the sportscasters because they can't really afford them. It's just too much money.
So quickly, before we go, we had a pretty big day here Monday, the Missouri School of Journalism, as we handed out our annual honor medals. We all had an opportunity to mingle with some of those honorees. Among them, Mike, we spent some time with folks from CNN Digital. Bill Plant was here from CBS News. Merrill Perlman, a New York Times copy editor who has since left the paper. But some wonderful, wonderful names that our school was able to bring here in honor this week.
Yeah, I was really impressed with Barbara Ehrenreich.
And I'd
met her once before, but she really talked about issues that I think are of concern, not only to our students, but to the university as a whole when she talks about income inequality. And even when she talks about journalists and the fact that many journalists aren't being paid for the work that they're doing, and those who aren't getting paid sufficiently for the work that they're doing. And I think that's a huge issue in our industry.
I thought there were very timely topics as well as really interesting people. And we had a panel that you were involved with that was talking about, you know, how women are treated or not being treated well in terms of equity in the structures of journalism today. And we had, I thought, Meredith Artley from CNN, who runs their digital mm-hmm. operations, who had a slightly different approach on how to deal with sexism in the industry, which was interesting.
And it was very interesting, if only because Meredith, being of my generation, that we've had a slightly different experience yeah. than generations before who really paved the trail for us and how we're able to reap the benefits of their hard work and how our strategy and approach is different as we bring the next generation into.
And I think it's also important to talk about the sort of the values that, you know, we still try to maintain in journalism despite all the changes in technology and platforms. Bill Plant, you mentioned mm-hmm. from CBS News. You know, he's in his 70s. He's been covering presidential politics for a long, long time. And yet here he was talking about this new movie about Dan Rather and Mary Mapes that's coming out this week and describing.
We talked about it in detail last week.
He was there and he had some very good comments about how you have to always remember if the story is too good to be true, you've got to make sure you verify it before you get out there and report.
And to me, those are the types of stories that our students need to learn, is that there are some values, there's some ethics there that you need to hold on to, the basics of journalism that transcend, I think, a lot of the technology that we talk about on a daily basis.
And I may be of that younger generation, but I tend to be one of those people that is very much more in the Bill Plant old school of shiny things may not get you the story. You got to go back to the basics of journalism. So it was refreshing to hear his perspective brought back into it. We're out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about on our Links blog. It's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @ViewsOnKBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.